Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, residents of Wisconsin's Central Sands region are taking large-scale farms to court over their water usage. We'll learn what's at stake. First, today's young people often experience high levels of anxiety. While many of us point fingers at things like too much screen time or social media use, our next guest has a different take. As a youth pastor, he spent plenty of time talking with young teens in his work. He noticed that many of the kids were feeling stressed and anxious about their everyday lives. So he decided to spend more time learning about what's causing them such high levels of stress. John Thornton Jr. is a Baptist pastor in North Carolina. His writing has appeared at Vox, Sojourners, and Commonweal magazine. He wrote the piece, I Work With Kids. Here's why they're consumed with anxiety, for Vox.com. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, John, when did you first begin to notice that these young people you were working with were experiencing a lot of stress and anxiety?
When I first started the church, I heard from parents and friends that are teachers that kids seem more stressed, they seem busy. And then right when I started, I read a book called Kids These Days by a guy named Malcolm Harris that I actually reviewed for Commonweal. And he gives a kind of structural account of how our institutions have changed. And he talks about school and the way that school had shifted towards kind of career preparation, getting students to think more about their jobs. And so I read that right when I started. And like I said, his account is pretty structural and institutional. And so I wanted to know, like, what does this actually look like? Like, what on the ground does this actually look like for the kids that I'm working with? And so I just decided to start asking them.
And so you were in a retreat setting with a group of high school students who came from slightly different backgrounds, went to different schools, and you asked them to think about how they would describe their lives in just a few words. And what did they tell you?
Right. So it was actually middle and high school students. It was about a dozen students, kind of about two per grade from 6th to 12th grade. So I just had them take, 3 or 4 minutes and just write down, like, how would you describe your life in 3 or 4 words? And then we came back together and we had a whiteboard in the middle of the room. My handwriting is awful, so I had one of the students write down their answers, and we just kind of built a consensus. So we just kind of went around and someone said, well, stressed. And I go, okay, so who else feels stressed? Mm-hmm. Everybody's hand went up. I said, exhausted. Okay, who else feels overcommitted? And we got a series of words on the board. And so then I said, okay, so where do you feel these things? And that's when we started opening up the conversation of what their lives looked like and where these things were happening in their lives.
And what did they tell you? Where was this stress and anxiety coming from for them?
So the first thing that was just kind of a moment that where I was like, whoa, that's one that's different than when I was in middle school and high school. I'm 32. I graduated high school in 2005 and college 2008. Was when one of the middle schoolers said, yeah, it's just so stressful, you know? I mean, you're just worried about getting your grades sent to your phone. And I kind of stopped for a second and said, wait a minute, what do you mean? When I got my grades, they just handed them back to me, you know, in class, and then we'd get a report card. We hadn't moved to, like, online grading yet. And she goes, yeah, like, you know, we all have, they all have a kind of portal that their school uses for their grades to go online. And then, like all of our apps, you know, they go to their iPads and their phones. And so they get push notifications when a grade goes up. Now, they can turn these off, but that was a moment where I was like, whoa, that would be really stressful, right? Like, you would be out at the movies with your friends on a Friday and your teacher's probably up late grading with a bottle of wine, and then all of a sudden you and your parents get a push notification that your grades have come in. And you find out, you know, you bombed a test or something like that.
Well, and I want to stop you there because what you just said is another layer to it. Their parents are also getting these notifications.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, sitting at dinner with your parents, and as we all do, we check your phones, and now all of a sudden you found out that, like I said, yeah, you bombed an assignment, or even you did well, and then you feel that sense of relief. But it's just kind of it's just right there with a sort of immediate access to your life. The way I put it in the piece was that, you know, a lot of times we think of phones and technology as distractions or ways for for kids to remove themselves from social situations. But what I was actually seeing was that it was also, it went the other way. It was a way for their school to sort of intrude in their lives.
Well, and so much of what they're doing for school is technology based. So it feels like it would be really hard to kind of tease out the things like, oh, this is an okay thing to interact with whenever versus the, oh, the push notifications are a real problem.
Oh, totally. I mean, it'd be like asking anybody, you know, doing your job without email. You just kind of couldn't do it. I mean, you could, but it's just so woven into the fabric of things. They also all use a Remind, which is an app that it's kind of a texting app where teachers and the school can send out notifications to them to like remind them about homework. And so, you know, think about when I was a kid, like I just didn't have a phone with that capability. So I kept a calendar. I was in control of it. And some of the kids really like it because they would be horrible at keeping a calendar. I tried to plan events with them. I know they're not very good. They need these reminders. But then others, right, like they're really good at keeping time. And so it's just there's not a one size fits all, but they're all having to use these and they're not being taught. No one's taking a step back of asking which ones might be helpful for which students. It's just all for everyone.
We're talking with John Thornton Jr. He's a Baptist pastor in North Carolina, and we're talking about the piece he wrote recently for Vox.com called I Work With Kids, Here's Why They're Consumed With Anxiety. And John, one of the things that I think is really important to look at is the idea of career readiness. And, you know, in some ways, this is nothing new. There was a Facebook comment from Brandy who said, I graduated high school 18 years ago, and back then I remember all the pressure. They made it seem like you had to know what you wanted to do the rest of your life. I never knew you could begin college undeclared or that you could change your major. And I graduated high school a lot longer ago than 18 years. And that was true then, too. You know, there was this, you know, how am I going to decide what to major in? And, you know, I wonder if I'll get in. What can I do to make sure that that I set myself up for success? But it feels like what you've written about, kids today are really having that pressure multiplied and magnified to a level that it's really, really unhealthy.
Totally. And I hear that. And I hear and I was the same way. You know, I was thinking about what I might want to do with the rest of my life when I was graduating high school. What I began to notice with these kids is that it is now, it's not just people asking them to think about that. It is woven into the fabric of their education. So I mentioned in the piece that a middle schooler had been asked to fill out a life plan, and that included things like career, but also what school to go to, what major to take, those sorts of things. I've since done some more digging and found that this is basically like a state-by-state curriculum that's being put out there, and I would encourage listeners to look this up. I think in Wisconsin it's the ACP, Academic and Career Planning, and so it starts in middle school. And I think the big difference is not asking them to think about their futures, but the extent to which their careers are tied so closely into their education, and this every grade, every volunteer hour, things like that. And it starts in middle school with very specific questions and then carries on through high school. I mentioned in the piece these career cluster classes. And so high schools all over the country now are it's not just deciding what you want to major in college. It's actually taking classes in high school on agricultural business, finance. There's like about a dozen of them. So it's starting even earlier. It's not just needing to figure out what you're going to declare when you get to school. It is picking your high school classes around your career. Mm-hmm. And even beginning to think about that at sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. We went to a summer camp together, and there were a bunch of churches, bunch of different churches were gathered together, and they actually asked some of the kids, you know, in preparation for like one of the lessons that night, what is it that, you know, you want God to give you relief from? And they had a sixth grader who said he was really stressed about picking which high school to go to because there's a STEM high school near him, and he wants to go to a STEM high school, but they don't offer band, and he wants to go to a STEM high school because he wants a career in a STEM field, but they don't offer band, and he really loves band. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there just like, it's like breaking my heart. Like, you shouldn't have to decide that, but I think that's the it's not just the pressure to know once you leave high school. I mean, it's literally sixth grade kids trying to decide which high schools to go to on their career trajectory and having to decide that in the course of their schoolwork and shaping their schoolwork around that.
Well, and it's interesting, John, because I could see an argument being made for this kind of structure and direction and trying to get kids engaged in thinking about their futures, for especially for kids who maybe are not getting support at home, or maybe parents who didn't go through a college process and so are kind of lost in how to help their kids. I could see an argument being made, well, you know, we're doing this so that all kids have access to this, but it seems like what all kids are getting access to is the same high level of stress.
Yeah, I think that's right. And at some point, it could be a diminishing return, right? And the fact is, people do change. On the one hand, people change their minds about what it is they want to do. But I also think it's preparing to send kids into a world in which careers exist. And we know that looking at kind of the last 20 years of large kind of economic developments, right, that people change jobs a lot, that jobs are a lot less secure than they used to be. The idea of a career, whether that's working in one field for the rest of your life or even for a particular company, I mean, that doesn't really happen anymore. I want kids to think about the future, and I think that's important, but I think I worry about locking them in so closely to a particular field or area of study or work, what that's setting them up for.
We're talking with John Thornton Jr., a Baptist pastor in North Carolina. He wrote the piece, "I Work With Kids, Here's Why They're Consumed With Anxiety," for Vox.com. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Why do you think today's young people are experiencing so much anxiety? If you are a young person, we especially want to hear from you. Is thinking about your future and trying to make the best decisions stressing you out? What could the adults around you do to help? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about anxiety in young people with John Thornton Jr. John's a Baptist pastor in North Carolina and wrote the piece, "I Work With Kids, Here's Why They're Consumed With Anxiety." That was for Vox.com. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, teacher, or work with young people in some capacity, do you see an increase in anxiety in the teenagers in your life? Do you think we expect kids to think about their future too early? And do we talk too openly about financial stress with our kids? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave us a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And John, I just mentioned the financial stress, and that's something that I think is really interesting, because the landscape of what it takes to succeed has really changed. And it seems like a lot of kids today are feeling like all of this preparation and making the right decisions isn't about thriving, it's just about surviving. Where is that coming from?
Well, you know, I was wondering the same thing myself, and I started thinking about the fact that so many of these kids' parents and teachers and, you know, the adults in their lives, like me, who's, like I said, 32, I'm a millennial, have realized that something is sort of off with the kind of bargain, right, that you work hard, you do your job well, you get pretty good grades, and financially you'll be okay, right? You can maybe move up a little bit, but that's kind of the deal. That has certainly not always been true for everyone in this country. But that idea, and then I was like, oh, well, a lot of the adults in their lives are Gen X and millennials, the first two generations in about 100 years to do worse than their parents. So while I don't think a lot of us that are involved in their lives are explicitly telling them that financially and economically things are off, I also don't think we're telling them that kind of myth anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know that I couldn't do that honestly, to tell them that this is all going to pay off, that you aren't going to have to worry about things like student debt or massive hospital bills, or that you'll one day be able to afford to buy a house. And so I'd never heard them talk about those things. I didn't ask. I haven't asked, but I don't know. It seemed to make sense to me. Like, why would the adults in their lives be telling those things if they themselves haven't experienced it?
Well, and I wonder how much is telling them versus, it seems like something that maybe two parents talking to each other, or a parent and a friend, or, that it's just how they express their feelings about their lives and the trajectory that they've had. They might have kids in high school and they might still be paying off their own student debt. And so it feels like the kids are kind of steeped in this environment of, you know, it used to be enough to get decent grades, graduate from high school, then it was graduate from college, and now it's kind of all bets are off. You know, you better hope that you get lucky.
Totally. And I think kids are perceptive and they pick up on these things. I had, there's a student in the youth group, and they were sort of out of town, and her mom wound up breaking a bone in her foot and was in a good deal of pain, and they had to drive like 2.5 hours to come back to a hospital that was in network. And the student had to drive the parent. And so think about, like, okay, so if you pick up on that, and this is a family that does pretty well, and they still were going through this to, like, be careful to make sure you go to the right hospital to stay in network. I mean, like, that's the kind of thing that by the time you're in high school, you pick up on those things. So I think kids are picking up on this, and I don't know quite what to do about it. The other way I've discovered that they probably are seeing these things more clearly, when I was digging around for the piece just to find some, like, interesting stuff, I found the 2014 AP English exam. And in the essay that it asked students to compose, the prompt starts off, the very first sentence says, "Many recent college graduates have faced record levels of unemployment." And then it gives them six sources that make various cases for why people should and shouldn't go to college. One of them just has a chart that just shows stagnated wages for college students. So this is in 2014, and 500,000 students across America took that test. So it's right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're hearing it. And so some of it's picking up on conversations, but 500,000 students took that test and just read. And these are AP students, so they're taking these classes to get college credit and just being told right to their face what life is like out there.
Let's go to the phones, and Gabe in Bayview is up. Hi, Gabe.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to share?
I just wanted to say that I think people are young kids more so, and older teenagers are forced into thinking what they want to do basically for the rest of their life. And I just went into the trade myself, so I'm at that point where it really starts to matter. And, you know, it's not like I regret my decision, but, you know, there's a lot of things that I'd rather be doing. There's too much strain put on a young mind to what they want to do for the next 60 years, you know.
And Gabe, do you have a sense of at what age you really started being aware of, geez, I have to make the right decision, and I have to make the right decision now?
Honestly, right when I got out of high school. That was from the get-go. At that point, I was panicking. I moved out west. You know, I did a bunch of stuff, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, because I was forced into thinking what I wanted to do so early on.
Well, Gabe, thanks so much for sharing that. And John, I'm guessing that what Gabe had to say is similar to what you've been hearing from the kids you work with.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I mean, think about how for so many people, those first few years out of high school, or whether they're in college or not, tend to be a period where kind of explore, figure out what you want to do, maybe change majors if you're in college, try out a few things. But hearing what Gabe described is that you're being set up to, right out of the gate, have to figure it out.
We had a caller, Gina from Bayfield, who is an educator with kids in middle school and high school, and she wonders how much of this is pressure from the schools themselves.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was interesting talking to the kids is, like, they I never heard them complain, or I've heard them, the proportion that I heard them complain about individual teachers or assignments was so minimal compared to the things that I named in the piece and that we've been talking about today. They seem to have a sense, because I actually asked them at one point on the retreat, like, do you think your teachers want this for you? And, like, is this... And they kind of got that, like, this probably isn't what the teachers want or how they want to be, you know, as individuals. I worked at an elementary school right out of college in Waco, Texas, and it didn't seem odd to me 10 years ago, but in hindsight, it was pretty wild, the amount of pressure that was put on the third through fifth graders with regards to the standardized test, because this has all these, like, funding implications. And we had a big pep rally when we got, like, a really good test score, and it was a low-income school. And, yeah, so I think the schools play an instrumental role in this, but I also don't want to say chalk that up to any one individual teacher or say there's an individual educator to blame. I have friends that are teachers, and it's pretty brutal.
Well, John, thank you so much for sharing your reflections with us and for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
John Thornton Jr. is a Baptist pastor in North Carolina. His writing has appeared at Vox, Sojourners, and Commonweal magazine. He wrote the piece, I Work With Kids, Here's Why They're Consumed With Anxiety, for Vox.com. Coming up, the death of a baby spurred residents of Wisconsin's Central Sands District to sue large-scale farms. We'll find out more. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at Wisconsin's cash bail system and talk about how it affects the number of people held in jail before they're tried. Now, residents in Wisconsin's Central Sands region are suing one of the biggest dairy farms over water access. Residents allege that the farm's massive irrigation rigs are using an unsustainable amount of water and that fertilizer pollution is making water undrinkable. Our next guest has been following the story and is here to break down what's happening with the lawsuit. Josephine Marcotti recently retired as an environmental reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She's now a part-time writer for the Star Tribune's weekly science page. Josephine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. So let's start with the big picture. What role does water play in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin?
Well, water plays a big role everywhere. It's especially true in that part of the state because there are sort of two, opposing demands for it. One, it's a very popular recreation area. People in Wisconsin love their water, and they love the activities they can do on water. And at the same time, it is a major agricultural region, and the farmers need and use that water for irrigation.
And this has not always been as productive an agricultural area before as it is now. What role did high-capacity wells and irrigation systems play in making this such a dominant agricultural area?
It is truly key to what agriculture has been able to accomplish there. And if you look at the data from the Wisconsin DNR, where you can track all of the development of the high-capacity wells over time, and it's really been a long, steady growth, which has really exploded in the last 10, 20 years. Farming there really wouldn't be possible. Farming at that level would not be possible without irrigation.
And what kind of evidence is there? Like you were saying, there's a lot of recreational water use. You talk about people seeing huge differences in streams and lakes in that area because of irrigation. What are some of the concrete ways that that's showing up?
Well, you know, the Central Sands area is, there has these lovely little lakes, in part because it's so sandy. And also there's hundreds of trout streams there, but the science has shown that there's a very clear direct connection between groundwater and surface water. It's much more direct than you get in most other kinds of most other regions, just because it's just a big sandbox. So when in dry years, even without irrigation, you can see lake levels drop and stream levels drop. But the combination of dry years with irrigation can be truly detrimental to some of those lakes, according to some of the science out of University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. I mean, lakeshore owners could see their you know, the water just dropped by feet, and you know, trees grow up, you know, back where there used to be docks. So you can see a really direct connection there between water and dry years and irrigation.
So that's specifically water usage, but there's also the issue of water contamination. Why is an area like the Central Sands so susceptible to water contamination?
Well, the groundwater is very shallow, and so when people put in wells for their homes, they can't go below the pollution. So because of bedrock. So, you know, the wells can only go down as you know, 100 or 200 feet at the most. And that's exactly where the water is contaminated because the fertilizers and the manure percolate straight from the surface down through the sandy soils and into the groundwater. And then it moves across, you know, across the land toward whatever river it's headed for, which is in the Central Sands is generally speaking the Wisconsin River.
We're talking with Josephine Marcotti right now. She recently retired as an environmental reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She's now a part-time writer for the Star Tribune's weekly science page. And we're talking about a lawsuit that is pitting residents of Wisconsin's Central Sands area against large agricultural firms. And you mentioned fertilizers, Josephine, and nitrates are one of the big contaminants that come from that. What do high nitrate levels mean environmentally and for human health?
High nitrate levels do have an effect on aquatic life, on fish and invertebrates, on frogs. I mean, it affects, high nitrates can affect animal life just like it affects people. It is one of the few agricultural contaminants for which there is a health standard issued by the EPA, and that's been around for many, many years, and the standard is 10 parts per million. It was based, it is tied to a condition that infants get called blue baby syndrome. There's a much more long and complicated scientific name that I can never remember, but I always think it's called blue baby syndrome because the nitrate molecules attach to the blood cells in a baby's body, and they block oxygen from getting into the body, which is why babies turn blue, and they call it blue baby syndrome. But there are also, in recent years, they're beginning to see other health issues related to nitrate, some cancers, and also some reproductive issues in pregnant women, and also neurological development problems in infants, one of which is called anencephaly or neural tube defects. So the recent science shows that there may be other reasons to worry about nitrate other than just blue baby syndrome.
And I want to point out that our colleagues at wiscontext.org have done some reporting on blue baby syndrome, and people can find that reporting there. And it was actually a mother's very anguished blog post about the death of her infant because of these contaminants that really sparked this lawsuit. Selena Stewart's baby died, and how did the communities respond?
You know, I heard about this after the fact. Her baby died in 2016, and I started reporting on this last year, so that would have been 2018. And I think that the reaction to what happened with Selena, it took a while to build within the communities, all of which are sort of around Wisconsin Rapids. There's the town of Nakusa, and where a lot of people live, and that's where she lived. But she had a baby that had a neural tube defect, and she was faced with a really horrible choice, the kind of choice that, you know, parents sometimes experience when they have a baby with developmental issues. She knew that if she carried the baby to term, the baby would most likely die. And then if she decided to end her pregnancy, then the baby would also die. And so she was faced with that terrible choice. Because of the severity of the malformation, and I think several months after they experienced that, she wrote a blog post, she made public her story. And even though the blog post didn't really mention high nitrate in drinking water, all the people who lived in that community, which is very small, you know, knew what had happened and knew what some of the health risks were. And over time, I think the concerns and sort of the anger just began to build. You know, there's not really any true evidence that her child developed that condition because of high nitrate, it's an affiliation. I mean, there has been some research that shows that women who are exposed to high nitrate have higher incidence of those kinds of problems with their infants, but it's not a direct link.
And so a lawsuit has been filed. What stage is that at now?
You know, the lawsuit was filed in November, and so I'm assuming now that the attorneys are going through a process of discovery. It may also be that they're talking about potential settlement. That often happens in lawsuits like this too, where they figure out a way to resolve the problems for the people in the community.
And what has industry's response been to date?
You know, they have not. They didn't agree to sit down with me for an interview. At least the Wysocki Family Farms, which is the company involved with the drinking water issues in that part of the state. But you know, they say what they have taken steps to help local residents get clean water. They are providing them with bottled water if they need it, or treatment systems in their homes if they want that. They are working with the Wisconsin DNR and the Environmental Protection Agency to come up with some kind of long-term solution, and then I think they're also working on doing more well monitoring to try to get a better sense of how widespread the problem is. So they also say that in some of their statements, both to me and in their press releases, that they blame what they call legacy nitrate contamination, meaning that this was nitrates or fertilizer that were applied, you know, over time, over many decades.
Well, certainly a lot there, and we'll keep following this story. Josephine, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure.
Josephine Marcotti recently retired as an environmental reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She's now a part-time writer for the Star Tribune's weekly science page. She joined us today to talk about a fight over drinking water between residents in central Wisconsin and large-scale farms. Coming up next, we'll talk to a reporter who spent some time looking at Wisconsin's cash bail system and a handful of people from different sides of the issue who are looking to change it. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a record number of women are serving in Congress as the result of the midterm elections. We'll find out if that trend trickled down to Wisconsin's legislature. First, the cash bail system has gotten a lot of national attention lately. California became the first state to pass a law eliminating the system last year. That law's on hold for the moment, but lawmakers and advocates in at least seven other states are trying to do something similar, including here in Wisconsin. Our next guest spent some time reporting on the effects of our state's cash bail system and the people trying to change it. Emily Hamer is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her latest piece is titled "Poor Stay in Jail While Rich Go Free: Rethinking Cash Bail in Wisconsin." Emily, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So broadly speaking, how does the cash bail system work?
So when a defendant is arrested on a crime, they're taken in, and usually they sit in jail for a little bit, and then they're taken to the judge for the judge to make a bail decision for them. And the judge can decide whether or not they want to assign a cash bail amount for that defendant or whether or not they want to just release that defendant on a signature bond. So like in Dane County, they're really trying to give signature bonds to defendants who don't need to be in jail. And what that means is they just sign a promise that they'll return back to court. And if they break that promise, then sometimes they'll have to pay money, but they don't have to post the bail amount before they're released from jail.
And that's also called being released on your own recognizance.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so where do people get money for bail in general? What are the options if they have a cash bail?
So in a lot of other states, one option is bail bondsmen, if you give a bail bondsman 10% of the bond amount, they'll post it for you. But that's outlawed in Wisconsin because as soon as you post that 10% to the bail bondsman, you lose that money. So not having that avoids a lot of abuse to the system and prevents poor people from getting taken advantage of. But if they don't have the money at all, there aren't very many options. There are bail funds in Wisconsin to help people poor people post and get out of jail, but they're pretty limited. And so when people can't post their bail amounts, if they don't have friends or family in order to post that cash for them, they just get stuck.
So numbers show that pretrial detentions are rising in the United States. Do we know why it's rising?
Mm-hmm. So there's data from the pretrial or from the Prison Policy Initiative that shows just that jail incarceration rates have been rising since 1983. And I think that's the earliest back that they have data. And as soon as it hits 1996, you can see the unconvicted or the not convicted population, the pretrial population, sort of diverge from the people who are in jail who have been convicted. And the unconvicted population just sort of starts to rise. And so from 1996 to 2016, pretrial jail incarceration has accounted for all of the net jail growth over that time period. Mm.
So there are people who have been arrested for something but have not been convicted yet. They are sitting in jail. They may have been offered cash bond, but they are not able to raise it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people who can raise it. Those tend to be people with more means, either their own or their network of friends and family. So the people that end up sitting in jail waiting to go to trial, what kind of impact does that have on their lives? What kind of ripple effects?
Mm-hmm. So it's been shown to kind of affect all aspects of their lives. Like, they can lose their jobs while they're in jail. They can lose their apartment for missing rent payments. If they lose their apartment and are evicted, if they don't have friends and family to help them through that process, landlords will sometimes just throw all of their belongings out onto the curb. And so not only have they lost their home, they've lost all of their possessions. They also can lose their custody with children can be affected while they're stuck for sometimes crimes that they didn't even commit. It really just has these ripple effects. And when those things happen to someone who is already vulnerable, it leads to them committing more crimes in the future. And so putting people behind bars before they've actually been convicted has been shown to lead to more crime later on, which is kind of the opposite of what we want to happen.
We're talking with Emily Hamer right now. She is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're talking about her recent piece looking at the cash bail system and the impact it can have on people who are waiting for trial here in Wisconsin. Now, Emily, you just talked about the issue that people who end up sitting in jail waiting for their trial actually often end up committing more crimes instead of less later. Another argument is proponents of cash bail say that it ensures that people show up for their trial date, but do the numbers bear that out?
Yeah, that's something that I thought was interesting as well, is that the numbers show, and research shows, that when someone is detained pretrial, if they're there for a short jail stay while they're not convicted yet, and they do get out before their court dates, they're actually less likely to show up for their court dates as opposed to if they hadn't been detained at all.
And so it seems like there are issues with the bail system, that it's not achieving what it's meant to. Are there some states that have gotten rid of cash bail?
Mm-hmm. There are some states who they have. I think a lot of them, they haven't actually gotten rid of cash bail, but they've just made it so burdensome to use. They've put all these roadblocks in place that judges are forced to consider other options, which in New Jersey and in Washington, D.C., they release most of their defendants instead of having them locked up or having them assigned a cash bail. In Washington, D.C. specifically, who has been doing this for a while now and not using cash bail, they release 94% of defendants pretrial, and most of them show up for court and do not commit new crimes when they're released.
You mentioned earlier that there's interest in Wisconsin at looking at the data, figuring out whether the system is really working or not. What kind of plans have been proposed to maybe not eliminate it, like you said, but mm-hmm. to use cash bail much more sparingly?
So there's a study committee right now that has judges on it. It also has some prosecutors, public defenders, members of the legislature, and they're really trying to brainstorm how to fix this in Wisconsin, but it's really complicated to address. Because one problem is if you get rid of cash bail, it has to be replaced with something, because otherwise defendants who we know are dangerous and pose a danger to the public if they're going to be released, we need some way to detain them. But right now in Wisconsin, that's called preventative detention or pretrial detention, is holding someone without cash bail. But Wisconsin doesn't really even have that option because there's a statute right now, but it's just unworkable. No one has ever used it. So the study committee is looking to try to create a preventative detention law. But then on the flip side, if you create a preventative detention law without limiting cash bail, it's just another way to lock people up. So they're trying to finesse this to get those things happening at the same time, but it's really complicated to tackle.
I find it interesting that you said that this group that's looking at this and working on this has players from all parts of the system. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if they all see that this would be good, better policy to pursue, mm-hmm. that says quite a bit about the issue.
Yeah, I think I've been going to some of these study committee meetings, and Judge Maxine White, the chief judge from Milwaukee County, she said at one of the meetings that she was surprised by how well they're working together on this. And that's really struck me, too, is that on both sides of the aisle, people seem to agree that this wealth-based discrimination where the rich can buy their way out of jail pretrial, but the poor get stuck, is just not something that we want to have happen. But it's just hard to come up with the laws that bring us to a system that we want.
And as we wrap up, Emily, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism has a second part to this story mm-hmm. coming out. What are you looking at there?
So another tough challenge with this is figuring out who to detain pretrial and who not to detain, because no one can know the future, and you don't know which defendants are going to go out and commit another new crime and put the public in danger. So a lot of judges and states and counties across the nation are using risk assessment tools, which are they're these computer programs that use actuarial science in order to try to predict which defendants are riskier than others and which ones are low risk. And so, but there is controversy surrounding them, whether or not they are discriminatory, whether or not they actually work. So my story is looking at those tools.
Very interesting. We'll definitely want to talk with you about that as well.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
That was Emily Hamer, a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She was with us to talk about a story she co-reported titled Poor Stay in Jail While Rich Go Free, Rethinking Cash Bail in Wisconsin. You can find that article online at WPR.org/Central Time. If you're listening right now, I'm hoping you're a fan of Central Time and the Ideas Network. Well, here's a chance for you to be part of making it all happen, or to share this opportunity with someone else who may be a great fit. We're looking for a producer who's an avid information consumer with eclectic interests and a passion for how stories are told on radio. This person is excited to find engaging guests and topics with a special focus on what makes Wisconsin a unique and wonderful place to live. And thriving in a fast-paced, deadline-driven environment is a must. It's a great opportunity to learn the science and art of great radio as part part of the knowledgeable, supportive, and fun Central Time team of professionals. To get all the details and to find out how to apply, go to WPR.org/jobs and click on Talk Producer Afternoons. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk with the engagement editor of WisContext to understand what the 2018 election looked like in terms of how many women were elected to the Wisconsin legislature. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.